Earth Sky.
Welcome to Earth Sky 22, 22 minutes of science and music from Austin, Texas. I'm Jorge Salazar. This week, science interviews on the doomsday prophecies of year 2012, the global night sky and constellation Scorpius, and a scientist explains why it's important to share the story of how the universe was created. Here's a scientist soundbite.
All intelligent life is going to be made of this rarest stuff in the universe. But we're at a very special moment for our planet and especially our species. And that's why I think it's so important that people start to understand that the voice of science speaks with a great deal of consensus on issues like this. These are not things that are highly uncertain.
You're listening to astrophysicist Joel Premack of the University of California at Santa Cruz. Dr. Premack is a leading scientist on dark matter, material that doesn't interact with light or other radiation, but is thought to make up the bulk of our universe. He joins us now from radio station WBEZ in Chicago to talk about his new book, The New Universe and the Human Future. Dr. Premack, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for having me.
Now, what is the main idea you're trying to get across in your book, The New Universe and the Human Future?
There are really two. One is that in the last decade or so, we astronomers have, for the first time, developed a theory of the origin, structure, composition, evolution, and future of the entire universe that actually seems to be right, that's based on extensive astronomical data, and that's now predicting the future. The theory has repeatedly made predictions that turned out to be right. The other idea is that this new theory of basically our origins, combined with recent work in biology, has now for the first time given all of humanity a possibly shared creation story. It's a creation story that nobody made up. It's a story that we've discovered. And as far as we can tell, it's the true story. Having a story like this for the entire world, which was created by the worldwide scientific community, we hope can be a basis for a new shared picture of reality, which is something that the Earth desperately needs so that we can all work together on solving our big problems.
All right. I mean, you open your book with a question, what universe are we living in? And I mean, beyond the obvious answer of this one, I mean, as a scientist, why is this question meaningful?
I think it's really important that people realize that there is now a scientific consensus on these fundamental questions of how the universe works on the macro scale and also how life works. And I think this is an important ingredient in coming to consensus on how to solve our really big problems on Earth.
So would you tell us some of the nuts and bolts here of this creation story that was developed by the scientific community over time? What is the shared cosmology, I guess, that you write about, and why is it important that everyone share a story about how the universe was created?
The first thing that I think everybody has to appreciate about the new picture is that everything that we see with our telescopes, all the galaxies, the stuff that absorbs light like dust and planets for that matter, all of that stuff represents about half of 1% of what's actually out there. Most of the universe is invisible. Now, this is such a crazy idea that it took scientists quite a while to appreciate that that's what's really going on. The reason we take it so seriously is that the predictions that follow from this, the detailed theory that is behind this, are so successful. We can predict the distribution of galaxies, both in the nearby universe and in the early universe that we see as we look out in space to great distances. We can understand the cosmic background radiation, the heat radiation of the Big Bang, and we can understand it in all of its details as far as we can tell. So this theory does appear to be extremely successful. The two main ingredients, the invisible stuff, are called dark matter and dark energy. most of the mass in the universe is not made of atoms. It's not even made of the stuff that atoms are made of, protons, neutrons, and electrons. It's made of something else. And I have to start out by confessing right away, we don't know what this stuff is. But this is the sort of composition of the universe. As to how the universe evolved, the sort of creation story, there's lots of steps, and some of them are kind of technical. Briefly, we think that the Big Bang started with something called cosmic inflation, a sort of super expansion, which not only put the bang in the Big Bang, but also created the fluctuations in density, the slight differences from one region to another, that later grew into galaxies and clusters of galaxies in regions that are slightly higher than average density, and into what we call cosmic voids, where we don't find any galaxies in the regions of lower than average density. As time goes on, these small differences in density evolve into the great cosmic structures that we see in our telescopes. And we have a very detailed picture of how this works. Basically, the invisible dark matter stops expanding when the density gets a little higher than average. And then the ordinary matter, the atoms, fall to the center of these big dark matter blobs, and that's where stars form. And then generations of stars build up the rare heavy elements that our Earth and we ourselves are made out of. So that's the beginning of the next stage, which is biological evolution. And there, I think the most important thing to understand is that biological evolution seems to be largely a process of cooperation, where things that started as individual, sort of very simple cells came together to make complex cells with the formerly separate parts as organelles within cells, things like mitochondria. And then those cells learned how to form organs in bigger creatures, multicellular creatures. And in fact, it was the single-celled creatures that made our oxygen-rich atmosphere that made it possible for large creatures to evolve. So there have been a series of major changes as the universe has evolved, from inflation to ordinary expansion, the creation of galaxies, the evolution of the heavy elements, and then the evolution of life on planets formed largely of those heavy elements. Incidentally, the heavy elements, everything heavier than hydrogen and helium, which mostly came out of the Big Bang, represent 0.1% of the density of the universe. So that's the stuff we're made of, and that's the rarest stuff in the universe.
That was astrophysicist Joel Premack of the University of California at Santa Cruz. We're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. Find us as EarthSky on Facebook, EarthSky Science on Twitter, and at EarthSky.org. Deborah Bird joins us now on the global night sky and a constellation to look for in mid-July, constellation Scorpius. Welcome, Deborah.
Hello, Jorge. Scorpius is one of the very coolest constellations because you know how they always say that constellations don't look like what they're named for? Well, Scorpius, which is named for a scorpion, actually does look like a scorpion. It's a very beautiful, graceful line of stars with a curved part to it that looks like a curved tail of a scorpion.
Yeah, it can be easy to pick out in the night sky. And tell us about how to find it. What's going on with it?
Well, at this time of year, whether you're in the northern hemisphere or the southern hemisphere, you can see the constellation Scorpius. And the reason is that this constellation is highest in the sky in the evening now. So if you're on the northern half of Earth, you're going to want to be looking toward the south. If you're on the southern half of Earth, you're going to want to be looking more or less overhead. And again, you're just looking for this very graceful-looking line of stars with a large curved part of it that looks like a scorpion's curved tail.
And Scorpius, the constellation, has one of my favorite stars, Antares, the heart of the scorpion.
That's right. Antares, coincidentally enough, is a reddish star, and it's often called the ruby heart of the scorpion. It's a very beautiful star. We in the Northern Hemisphere sometimes say that Antares is a star that's known for twinkling very fiercely. And that's because, again, we on the Northern Hemisphere have to look southward to see this star. And when we look at something that's relatively low in the sky, we're looking through more atmosphere than when it's overhead. The atmosphere causes this fierce twinkling of Antares. If you're in the southern hemisphere, on the other hand, you're seeing Antares and the constellation Scorpius more overhead, and so you don't see Antares twinkle as rapidly.
So that's constellation Scorpius, available for people to see in mid-July.
Available for you in mid-July. And I love this Chinese name of Antares. The Chinese call it Fire Star.
Deborah, anything else to look for in constellation Scorpius?
Yes. If you're looking at the reddish star Antares, which is the brightest star in the constellation Scorpius, and you have a pair of binoculars handy, be sure to turn them on Antares. Not only will that intensify that reddish color, but also you might see a fuzzy patch near Antares. It's kind of to the lower right of Antares as you're looking southward. And it's actually a huge cluster of stars, a globular star cluster called M4. Very beautiful.
Thanks, Deborah.
Thank you, Jorge.
Earth Sky's Deborah Bird, and we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science.
Nothing is impossible. The future is not flawless. So let us work it out and keep the light there. Let's keep it going. We'll isolate the beauty gene. I put positive.
We're Earth Sky. We interview the world's top scientists. The year 2012 has become a phenomenon of sorts, with widely circulated doomsday prophecies, supposedly coming from writings made by ancient Mayan people who lived in what's now Mexico and Central America. On the line to talk about 2012 doomsday prophecies and what archaeologists know is Catherine Rees-Taylor, professor of Mayan archaeology at the University of Calgary in Canada. Dr. Rees-Taylor, welcome.
Thank you.
Now tell us some, what are the important facts that people should know about 2012 and the Mayan calendar?
Well, I think that what people should know about 2012 is that it is a date that is basically something that we created in the West, that the Maya did not predict the end of the world or even a huge transformation in the way that we're conceiving of it today. 2012 is a phenomena that came about through different kinds of grassroots spiritual movements and some interpretation of Maya writing that happened prior to really understanding what the glyphs were saying. It's an interesting phenomena, but there is no archaeological basis for this phenomena, and the Maya calendar does not really predict it ending in 2012.
Many people seem to be pointing to an ancient carving called the
Tortuguero Monument 6 as being a source of prophecies about this this year that has that supposedly has a lot of significance, 2012. Tell us more about this carving. What do scientists know about it, and what does it say?
Tortuguero Monument 6 is a monument that was carved during the late Classic period, which is from approximately 600 to 800 AD. And the monument has probably around 80 glyphs, 80 different phrases or words or sentences on the monument. So it's quite a long inscription. The very final 8 glyphs of the monument literally are the only ones that deal with the future date, 2012, in any real way. Of the hundreds of inscriptions that we have from the Maya area, those particular glyphs say that this date, which happens to be a date in the Maya long count, 13000, will happen. And on that day, this particular deity will descend, because he is the patron deity of something called period endings. Period endings are long cycles of time that end. So the Maya have a Catun, which is 20 years and is kind of like our decade, and they certainly have these 400-year periods, of which one is ending on December 21st, 2012. And this patron deity is going to descend because he is the patron deity that's going to oversee all the ceremonies that happen on this particular day. That is all that the Maya say about 2012 on December 21st.
Did you leave out the part about the end of the world?
No, because they actually didn't say that. Nowhere did the Maya say at any point in time that the world will end. They don't even say that their calendar will end and that it's going to restart. The Maya and many inscriptions talk about dates far into the future. They have a date that is at 4772 AD, more than twice as far ahead of us as 2012 is from our year one. So they have long, long periods of time in the future, and they do not conceive of the world ending or even the calendar restarting at that time. So the Maya really didn't concern themselves with this date nearly as much as we do now in the 21st century.
You've said that there are real effects the 2012 phenomenon has had on people living today in Latin America. Would you like to tell us what you meant by that?
Well, I think that you can't look at these doomsday prophecies and not think back to the Hale-Bopp comet period, where so many people believed that the Hale-Bopp comet was going to come along and there were aliens in the comet and they all committed suicide in order to be raptured up to the comet and taken away. There certainly is that kind of doomsday prophecy and those kinds of belief systems that are trickling their way into Latin America as well. And the Maya today have access to computers and the World Wide Web, and they also have TV and satellite TV and cable and all of the different kinds of documentaries that we're seeing on the Discovery Channel are also translated into Spanish and shown in Latin America. And so people are trying to look at everything that's going on in particularly North America and understand it in terms of their own worldview. So different religious leaders are incorporating aspects of the 2012 prophecies into their teaching in some very interesting ways. I have run across different religious leaders in the Maya area who believe that aliens are going to return, that there are going to be people from the Pleiades coming back, and that they are going to help us, enlighten us, and elevate us to a new level of consciousness. I don't think there's anything wrong with elevating the consciousness of the planet, but I do think that there is some kind of dangers in projecting this notion of aliens returning, asteroids returning and hitting the Earth. So I think it's important for science to clearly speak up and say there are no asteroids headed for the Earth. There is no Jupiter-sized planet that is hurtling towards us. We have way bigger things to worry about with what we're doing to the planet than to be scared of any of these doomsday prophecies coming true.
You've been listening to archaeologist Dr. Catherine Rees-Taylor of the University of Calgary in Canada. And that's our show. Thanks for joining us. This week's show was recorded at the Earth Sky Studios in Austin, Texas, the live music capital of the world. Our producer is Michael Brennan. Executive producers are Peter Zandan, Ryan Britton, and Deborah Bird. Our audio engineer is Eddie Campos. And special thanks this week to our musical contributors, The Sour Notes, 100 Flowers, and The Black and White Years. For more information on the science and the music you heard this week, visit our website at earthsky.org. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
There are too many artists, too much art, and not enough genius, I believe. Science is the art of the next stage. There are so many artists, too much heart, and not enough reason, I'm afraid. Silence is the song of the next stage. But what we don't know won't hurt us. What we don't know won't keep us up at night. What we don't know won't hurt us. But we don't know, but we don't know, but we don't. What you don't know won't hurt ya. What you don't know won't have you terrified. What you don't know won't hurt ya. But you don't know, but you don't know, but you don't. The art of the next day.